I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE. This week, we're asking, is it really all doom and gloom for the global economy? NATO nation media appeared shocked when OPEC Plus suddenly announced the slashing of oil production in stark contrast to the begging of a Biden administration that's only just had to bail out the second worst bank failure in US history. Joining me today to make sense of it all from the former financial center of the world, London, is Professor Daniel LaCaglia, chief economist at the Spanish wealth management fund Tresis, and he's been ranked as one of the top 20 most influential economists in the world. Thank you so much, Daniel, for coming on. Forget SVB, the Silicon Valley Bank. What about Credit Suisse? Because NATO nation media commentators seem desperate to say, look, this is nothing like 2008. And then we have Peter Schiff, CEO of Euro-Pacific Capital, who I think you know, saying this isn't going to get better. This is going to be worse than 2008. And we must remember that the numbers of hundreds of thousands of excess deaths that the 2008 crisis caused when it came to poverty, cold, hunger, 40 million in the USA are going hungry tonight.
Well, I think, thank you so much for having me. I think that it's somewhere in between, to be fairly honest. To say that it's nothing like 2008 and it's going to be just a small piece of news that doesn't transfer to a much larger risk makes no sense. But I think at the same time, that precisely because the problems of the financial sector are global and because of the excess debt that exists all over the world, when everybody's in deep trouble, then virtually no one is in deep trouble. So at the end of the day, there is a concerted effort, both from governments and central banks, to avoid a 2008-style crisis. However, the challenges obviously are enormous because we've had a decade of negative interest rates that has obliterated the balance sheet of banks and has created an enormous bubble that goes from sovereign bonds to cryptocurrencies. And what's happening right now is the destruction of capital of so many of those investments and loans that were made with a perception of valuation and a perception of a risk that certainly it was profoundly optimistic. No, so I think that.
But if that's the case, then so would you sympathize with former U.S. Treasury Nouriel Roubini saying, "Look, the U.S. banking sector is on the verge of catastrophe." He said unrealized losses on securities amounting to $620 billion, which, together with the higher interest rates, point to unrealized $1.75 trillion of losses.
Yeah,
the U.S. banking system is a goner.
I wouldn't say that the U.S. banking system in its entirety, but certainly there's going to be more episodes like Silicon Valley Bank. But I'm more worried about the European banking system, because the European banking system did not get out of the 2011 crisis with a cleanup of non-performing loans, with a cleanup of the balance sheet. At least in the United States, you get a shock. No? In the United States, you have mark-to-market on a monthly basis, on a quarterly basis, of all the assets, and therefore you can immediately see whether there is a big financial hole in a bank or not. In the case of the European Union, you have not just the challenges that were built up throughout the 2011 crisis and a decade of nominal negative rates, but on top of that, you have this very challenging situation with the convertible contingent bonds that can create a domino effect on the equity. So I think that usually when these things start, when these crises, the banking crisis starts, we always hear the same narrative, which is that the U.S., it's a problem of the U.S. banking sector and everybody else is fine. And then, as it happened in 2011, what we actually see is that the challenges are global. So I think that it's going to be a massive rebasement of the asset base that you just mentioned, and that is going to appear in the bond side and the equity side. Certainly, it's going
obviously,
to
obviously going central to take banks a while. Central banks in Europe deny all that and say they learned so much in the fallout of the 2008 crises and the crises that went after it. Do you you said it was everywhere, this situation. Arguably, where I'm speaking to you from, everyone's talking about a boom in entrepreneurial capitalism.
Yeah.
And same all around Southeast Asia. So it's not everywhere, is it? Isn't there a decoupled global economy going on here that while you're speaking to me from the old world where people are talking about imminent bank collapses with huge unrealized debt, and over here they're opening new banks and trying to start out whole new innovations and businesses backed often by Global South governments?
You've just mentioned a great word. I'm talking from the old world, you know, and what you're actually living in Southeast Asia, what you're actually living in the Middle East is actually banking the way that it should be, you know, that it should be done with real assets, with real prospects of growth and with opportunities and innovation, etc. Absolutely, but the global financial system is fully interconnected. So if there ripple effects can happen, but you're absolutely right that this time there is a huge difference between the banking system in the United States or the euro area relative to those countries in which there's been to start with, the first thing that none of those countries have had to do was create an artificial bubble through negative rates. Real rates and nominal rates were actually positive. So banks,
well, they have to keep up, don't they? Because they peg the currencies. They have to keep up with the money printing.
Exactly. They have to keep up with the money printing, but at least they keep up with the money printing in a sensible way, no? Which is to understand that the price of risk has to be real and has to be realistic, and that valuations have to be relatively comfortable so that the banks simply don't see a domino effect like Silicon Valley Bank saw, which was not a collapse because they invested in technology, but a collapse because they had a massive sovereign bond book that had to that generate those unrealized losses that you mentioned.
Albeit that there was investment from this region and Southeast Asia. I mean, just you were talking about it being interconnected. The fact that OPEC Plus reduced oil output, if things were really as interconnected as you suggest, they wouldn't want to be going to economic war de facto with the other side, the old world, would they? Are things really that interconnected anymore?
There are differences, absolutely. The reason I think that everybody was shocked by in the old world, as you say, about the decision to cut production from OPEC Plus, and certainly that raises a few questions. But it is also true that the OPEC Plus decision comes fundamentally from a weakening global demand picture. So, and the weakening global demand picture comes from the stagnation of the U.S. and the European economy, no? Which are huge importers of oil and gas. So I think that the decision is basically a reflection of everything that we're talking about now, is that they see that on the one hand, demand growth is not as expected. Second, that they've taken a measure to defend the oil price. And at the same time, they see very little in terms of negative ramifications on the producing countries. So we are seeing that you know, on the one hand, everything is interconnected, but on the other hand, there are pockets of regional exposures that allow producers, in this case, to take decisions that are probably more driven toward making the situation internally better rather than just as it used to be in terms of the OPEC policy. OPEC's policy used to be more about what would the United States do. That is not the case anymore at all.
Yeah, when arguably OPEC was a proxy. But just explain to me one thing, because obviously that was a decision with Russia, Saudi Arabia, UAE. Not sure whether it'll affect China very well, because it needs energy. And also, the fact OPEC Plus did this is surely a benefit to the United States, because the United States is the biggest oil exporter.
Oh, it is.
I never understand that in the media coverage of this. Explain why actually the United States benefits from this Saudi production cut and the Russian production cut.
Absolutely. The reason why the United States benefits from the OPEC production cut is because the United States has become the marginal provider of oil for the rest of the world when there's a reduction in production for many of the OPEC producers. The United States has gone to produce almost 11 million barrels a day, which is more than what Saudi Arabia or than Russia produced. And the fact that the United States has become almost energy independent is an important factor that, for example, has saved the European Union in its energy crisis by bringing liquefied natural gas from the United States when the tensions with Russia became more evident. So all of that is benefiting the United States. On the one hand, it's exposed.
Do you believe the Nord Stream was destroyed by the Biden administration? Because certainly you've just told me the motive.
Yeah, no, I don't. I don't know. No, but do you know who's the biggest beneficiary of the Nord Stream collapse? It was the Norwegian oil company, the state Norwegian oil company. That was, if you look at the earnings, that's the one. The United States didn't benefit from it.
Telling me about the LNG, though, and the opening of LNG terminals.
No, because it had already... It already had all of it sold in advance. So why would they implement such an action? It makes no sense to me. It was already sold in advance in long-term contracts.
Wait, so the US LNG that could go to Europe couldn't replace the LNG that would have gone through Nord Stream?
No, it wouldn't. The United States' ability to export is ample, but not unlimited. So it would not have sent more LNG to the European Union unless it would have put in danger the supply of the United States itself. Then that's not going to happen. You think about it, if they enter into a situation in which the arbitrage between the price in the European Union and the price in the United States is ample enough in order to make it more profitable to send to the European Union, the best way to do it is to enter into long-term contracts. Nobody in the oil and industry, as you know very well, wants spot volatility. Everybody wants as many long-term contracts as possible. And the United States, when the Ukraine invasion happened, they entered into the long-term contracts that they could. More would have been virtually impossible. So if there's any beneficiary of the Nord Stream collapse, it's the state-owned Norwegian company. And obviously, the North Sea producers.
Well, the Norwegian government obviously denies any involvement in the eco-atrocity of
course,
the Nord Stream explosion. I know you're not. You haven't been giving a motive. People can see our interview with Seymour Hersh on our Rumble channel. Professor Daniel Lacaille, I'll stop you there. More from the chief economist at the Wealth Management Fund, Tressis, after this break.
Shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Daniel Lacaille, Chief Economist at the Wealth Management Fund, Tressis. What has been the impact of sanctions on Russia from your viewpoint? Because, I mean, why was the ruble the strongest performing currency of 2022, given that the Biden administration themselves said the ruble will be rubble?
Well, the ruble is a very complicated currency. On the one hand, it has capital controls, so most Russian citizens simply cannot exchange rubles for US dollars or euros. So the exchange rate is relatively massaged or managed by the central bank. I think that basically, on the other hand, there's another reason, is that the global oil and gas market is global and fully interconnected. So sanctions against Russia have basically meant that Russia would export a lot more to China and India, which have been, as you mentioned prior, the main beneficiaries of receiving oil and gas at a discount from Russia. So basically what has happened is that the Russian economy has gotten into a massive trade surplus. That certainly helps. And the utilization, it's true that the utilization of the ruble as a currency is virtually inexistent globally. However, it is true that the interconnection with China and with India has significantly
and the gold reserves
strengthened. And the gold reserves, obviously. The gold reserves matter to a certain extent. Gold reserves are important. There is certainly the governor of the Russian Central Bank. She's a woman. I don't remember her surname. But she implemented a policy of defending the reserve base of the central bank in a very non-Keynesian way, not printing money massively. So not printing money massively certainly has helped stabilize the ruble in a situation that could have been, as you said before, very, very negative. But obviously, come back to the point, capital controls are a very negative thing for the Russian population that want to exchange those for euros or for dollars. But on the other hand, it has strengthened the ties with China, undoubtedly, and with India, and those two have basically offset all of the negative impact of exports to the European Union, and probably by a very, very large difference. No?
Well, the central bank governor in Moscow, Nabiulina, came under attack, yeah, arguably, for leaving loads of money in the United States as Russia went in to, as they saw it, defend the people of Donbass, which shows the problems of decoupling, doesn't it, from the American economy. Everyone in the global south all talking about decoupling, as you know, from the U.S. Currency. How difficult is it for China to decouple? I understand the latest figures show the sixth straight month of decline in U.S. Treasuries, lowest since 2009, $859 billion China owns of frontline U.S. debt. How careful do they have to be, and how easy? This is straight years of decline in U.S. debt buying by the Chinese government. They can't just pull the rug, can they?
No, absolutely not. We have to remember that for China, their huge U.S. dollar reserves, which are fundamentally in U.S. debt, are one of the principles of the strength of the central bank. It provides stability to the yuan. No, how easy is it to decouple from the U.S. dollar? It's very difficult, and the reason why it's very difficult is that when countries like China, Russia, India, so many other countries think of decoupling, the problem is that none of them think of what makes the US dollar the world reserve currency. And that is that there is, in a fire, it is the house with the largest number of windows and doors. It's liquidity. So the problem that one finds when you see alternatives to the US dollar, they may be non-state-owned, but state fiat currencies that could be an alternative to the US dollar, is that the perverse incentive of central banks and governments of implementing capital controls immediately make it impossible for that currency to be a world reserve currency.
Okay, but then perhaps we should define what decoupling is, and history is seeming to move much quicker every other week. You can still have a kind of peg to the dollar while being decoupled, i.e. probably not a buyer of US Treasury bills and debt, can't you? I mean, the yuan is kind of pegged to the dollar, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
in a way.
Absolutely. The yuan is fully pegged to the US dollar. If you think about it, the way that the PBOC, the Central Bank of China, manages the fixing of the yuan is fully aligned with what you just mentioned, which is the variability of the reserves.
But until the dollar starts declining massively, whereupon the Communist Party would surely say, no, we're not buying any more US Treasury.
Exactly, which could happen, but the reason why it doesn't happen or it's not happening is because there, at the end of the day, be it in bonds, be it in currencies, you always have to think of the US dollar versus something, or the US treasuries versus something. And the problem is right now that the alternatives are not feasible to offset the kingdom of the US dollar. To start with, the euro is the only world reserve currency that has redenomination risk. So, you know, we never know, but one day a country can decide to leave the euro and the entire house of cards can collapse, no? The yuan is a currency that has many positive things. You mentioned before the gold reserves, you mentioned the strength of the Chinese economy, absolutely, but it has capital controls, and that definitely...
Yeah, so it's not good for investment houses like yours and for financial institutions.
Yeah.
But as a reserve currency, it could be something for the future, obviously offering less ability to gamble and speculate on. Probably why you know... People like you probably don't like it very much. I've got to ask for your...
No, we like it.
Well, capital controls. I know you don't like capital controls, clearly. I mean, if we could just ask you your advice as to, given the higher oil prices, energy prices, and the risk of U.S. economic collapse and European economic collapse, what can Asian economies, Latin American, African, you know, China, what can they do to mitigate the risks? The World Bank is saying a decade of lost growth and saying we're all doom and gloom. What can the rest of the world, most of the world, do to mitigate the losses?
In my opinion, it's a very straightforward and simple answer, but it's a very complicated one to implement, which is avoid twin deficits at all costs. What is the problem? The problem is that everybody complains now about the risk of contagion, etc. But if you, from a government perspective, if a country from a government perspective decides to constantly go to massive deficits, be it on the fiscal or on the commercial front or both, then inevitably, you're becoming more dependent on the U.S. dollar. I come back to the point. It's where U.S. dollar...
Or you could just default on the deficit, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. But that doesn't work. That doesn't work whatsoever. Default is when a sovereign state defaults, it is the proof to the world that it's insolvent.
But it's to the old world, isn't it? It's to the old world. Argentina did that. If you do what you are saying and massively curb public spending just because you're obsessed by the deficit, like the government, like the national economy was some grocer's shop, as Mrs. Thatcher would say, you're in trouble, aren't you? Because you'll end up in a revolution, a political revolution, as you show.
Well,
public services.
Yeah. You just mentioned Argentina. Argentina is a country with 100% inflation. So yeah, it seems like a great idea to enter into massive debt and then not pay it. It's great. No, it looks like a good idea until you know what that means. What it basically means, ultimately, what is debt for one country is an asset for another country that is buying it, obviously.
No? Yeah, but you mentioned Argentina there, and of course there are countless countries in Africa. Isn't it merely that default a procedure, a stage in the development of a decoupled country from that US system? And we haven't even mentioned the IMF. Argentina is doing a bit better now than it was back in those days in the initial years after the default. Similarly, isn't this all about BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, decoupling? And a default is just on the way to it. I mean, I know China is a contributor to the IMF, I should say, but isn't it merely a staging post?
So think about this. Even if it's China is a very intelligent and very long-term country. The idea that a country is going to default on the United States or on the euro area, and that it's but it's not going to do it on China, makes no sense. A default process is in itself the destruction of the confidence in the government
by the markets.
Not just the markets, but by anyone that wants to lend to that country. So if I'm the Chinese government and I see a government that has defaulted 8 times, I guarantee you that the Chinese, who are very, very bright, very intelligent, and very know what they're doing with their money, they're not going to lend to that country, certainly in conditions that are going to be better than the ones that they were receiving before.
Unless it's a political default, arguably, and politics does have a mention if the debt was in the United States. Just one final question. Who is going to own Ukraine, given Russia's saying it doesn't want Kiev when this war, horrible war, ends? Is the IMF, is the debt, I mean, I don't know whether the debt will be defaulted on. Clearly, Ukraine is not the Ukrainian people's at the end of this war, regardless of Russia saying it doesn't want to take over Western Ukraine and Poland doesn't. Is it the International Monetary Fund and the Bretton Woods institution? Who is it that owns Ukraine? These are unbelievable sums of money going in to prop up that economy. Let alone the weapons.
What a good question. What a challenging one to respond. It's going to be a very long process of reconstruction that is going to require an incredible amount of money from different countries, and ultimately, it's going to be a question of whether that process happens like after the Second World War with Europe or similar, but it's a very difficult one to answer. I don't know. I certainly right now for me, I don't see that any of the possible outcomes that we read in the press seem to be the ones that will probably end up happening, no? But it's certainly going to be the reconstruction, the entire reconstruction of a country, and that I wouldn't say that the IMF is going to own it, but certainly without the IMF, I don't see it happening.
Professor Daniel Lacaille, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for the show. We'll be back next Saturday with world-renowned energy markets expert Anas Alhaji. But until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.